All right. Who remembers where we were when we left off?
The Bible.
We were in the Bible.
Oh, my gosh.
Well done.
Right before David in exile.
Yeah, right before David through the exile. Yeah, so who's the character who we finished off with really, really briefly?
Saul.
Saul.
Yeah. That's the guy.
Samuel and Saul, who we talked about last.
Well, I mean, I figured David in exile, I figured Saul was there somewhere.
Real quick look ahead. Today we're covering the Kings and Prophets. Next week we'll be talking VBS, and we'll finish up. We'll do a little bit of VBS stuff at the end of today. Following week, June 5th, Clint's going to do Ezra and Nehemiah. I look forward to that day. And then we'll cover the intertestamental period. I'm excited about teaching that one, too, because it's a big blind spot and lots of knowledge bases for Christian. So that's the last week. That's the calendar I was talking about, the thing that changed that nobody knew had changed, but doesn't matter. And apologies ahead of time if my voice cracks or if I get hard to understand. I'm a little bit sick, so
just a little bit.
It's okay. You have to deal with it. Yeah. Feel free to make fun of me. As long as you learn something in the midst of making fun of me. So review. Started out, we're looking at the story of the Bible, right? We're walking through the entire text, really. This whole thing is just one big survey, week by week. We start out in Genesis, and what happens in Genesis? What are the high points, the main things to notice?
He creates man, man sins, man gets kicked out of the garden.
What enters in the equation with sin?
Death.
And so, that's the conflict that starts this whole big story. And so, what's the resolution we're looking for?
A savior, the seed.
The seed. Somebody who's going to come and fix the problem, crush the head of the serpent.
Yeah, it's a
fix the problem of sin and death. And then we followed the characters as it went. We looked at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Right, these repeated promises that God made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and to his descendants, that you would have land, seed, and blessing. Remember what land he promised Abraham?
Land from the Nile to the Euphrates.
From the Nile to the Euphrates, right? How did he promise blessing?
Like the stars or the sand.
Those would be your descendants, right? That's the seed. So yeah. And then the blessing was?
If you obey his commandments, then he will bless you.
Close. Yeah. I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Right, that's what I'm looking for. So that's the land, seed, and blessing part. And then we get to the Mosaic Covenant, and that's where adds this whole layer. Now we're dealing with the nation of Israel and how they're interacting with God. Moses and the law. And that's when you get blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. Deuteronomy 28. And this look forward, we're still looking for this seed who's going to save the world, but now we know he's coming through the line of Judah. So we walked through Moses, right? The Exodus out of Egypt and receiving the law and heading into the land of Canaan to conquer it, and then what happens? They get scared at Kadesh Barnea. They say we can't do it, and so they wander for 40 years. Then Joshua comes along 40 years later, and they get it right, kind of. They go in and they take the land, right? Joshua conquers all of the land of Canaan. After Joshua conquers the land, what period comes about?
The judges.
Right, living in the land with the judges, and the theme of the book of Judges. You remember how you find the theme of the book of Judges? Where is it?
The last verse.
The last verse in the book of Judges. You want to know what the book of Judges is about? Go read the last verse. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There was no king in Israel in those days. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and it's just this story of over and over again, the people of Israel being restored to right relationship with God. And then doing what was right in their own eyes instead of doing what was right in God's eyes and falling away from him. And this constant repetitive swing back and forth. Samuel comes along at the end of Judges, beginning of 1 Samuel, and this new era kind of enters in. And so you mentioned it earlier. What did the people ask Samuel for?
A king.
They want a king. Why do they want a king?
That's predicted.
That's predicted.
Because everyone else has one.
Everybody else has one. Make us like all the other nations. Give us a king. So that's where we are. He finds them a king. He finds them Saul.
Saul, he was the one that could sing, "I just can't wait to be king."
Yeah.
thank you for being the distraction.
So we're into 1 Samuel now.
Oh, we're recording that, right? That was
we'll
not
edit that
planned.
Clint, please, to be exact.
But now you have to ask a really, really complicated question to make it sound smart.
Yeah.
I was going to make a comment about, I don't know if you guys have heard this before, but you know, Moses was not allowed to go into the promised land. It was Joshua that took the Jews into the promised land. Joshua is a derivative of Yeshua or Jesus. So it's Moses represents the law, so it's not the law that gets us into the promised land. It's
Yeshua.
It's Yeshua or Josh who gets us to the promised land.
That's pretty cool. Josh, this is on you, dude.
I don't like all this pressure.
All right, so today, or so for the past 5 weeks, we've covered this much material, and today we're covering this much in one sitting. So it's going to be a lot more of an overview, looking at the general themes and less at the details, because the details are pretty consistent. They're pretty repetitive after we get through Solomon. So what we're going to look at now is kind of the period of when Israel, the nation of Israel, is governed by the kings, and the system of kings and prophets kind of develops. Saul is the first one. Samuel, chosen by God, anointed by Samuel in 1 Samuel 9, and he starts out a successful leader. He goes, he leads the nation into battle against the Philistines and against the Canaanites, and wins battle after battle, and then there's a shift, and it goes to his head. You know the old saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that was true in Saul's case. It goes to his head, and he decides that he is the guy who makes the rules and not God, and during that interplay, this other guy comes along, David. That's Donatello's David, by the way. There's three famous David statues, Donatello, Michelangelo, and Bernini. So you have Bernini on your paper. That's Bernini's David. That's my favorite. You guys all know what Michelangelo's David looks like.
Yeah.
And then Donatello's David is there. David comes along for 1 Samuel 16. This is after Saul's kind of turn goes down. He decides not to kill the king of the Amalekites, and Saul says, okay, God has rejected you as king then, and he's going to go find one, a different one, a man after his own heart. And David ends up being that guy. So chapter 16 of 1 Samuel is where we first see David come on the scene. Anybody know the story of how David gets anointed king? Do you want to summarize it for me?
What's his name? The prophet went to all of his brothers. Yeah, went to all of his brothers.
Jesse's sons,
right?
Right.
And looked through like all of them, but then couldn't find anyone. And then he asked if that was all of the sons that he had, and he said no. That David was tending sheep.
Yeah.
And David was a man.
Yeah, the smallest one. You're not supposed to expect him. And God says, "Look, I'm not looking at what man looks like on the outside. I'm looking at the heart, and so I choose David."
16:7.
Right after that, David gets inscripted into Saul's service as his harp player, right? He goes and he's trying to calm King Saul down. King Saul has an evil spirit at that point, and he is always angry. He's always looking over his shoulder, thinks people are out to get him, and David starts being employed as his harp player, trying to calm him down. David and Goliath, chapter 17. You guys know that story, I hope, I think. If there's things that I'm assuming you know that you don't, please stop me. We don't want to go over too quickly. The 18, 19, 20, 21, really through 31 is the interplay of David and Saul. Of Saul is king and David's not, but David is the anointed one, the guy with God's blessing, and Saul isn't. And so there's this constant back and forth of Saul's trying to kill David, and David's like, I'm not trying to take your kingdom, but I'm going to defend myself if you try to kill me. And David goes off, runs away, and basically goes throughout all of the nation of Israel, bands together his mighty men, and starts forming a pretty sizable army that's kind of his. And they're these roving band of David followers.
Rogues.
Thanks. Yeah, good word.
Awesome army,
like an X-Men.
Or Ronin, whichever one.
1 Samuel ends with the death of Saul. He's come to the end of his rope. He's losing in battle after battle. David is off being successful. Clearly has the blessing of God on him. And in a last-ditch attempt, he goes to a medium at Endor. Saul does. He's a medium, a witch. And he says, summon Samuel up from the grave for me to give me advice. And she does it. And Samuel's like, why'd you call me up? You shouldn't have done this. This is wrong. And you're going to die. And Saul's like, okay. So, next chapter, Saul dies. David then kind of moves in. And 2 Samuel is all about David's reign. It's all about what David did as king. First few chapters are the transition from Saul to David. There's still some guys who are, you know, loyal to Saul after he's dead who want to continue the reign through Saul's line. So there's some back and forth there. Joab and Abner and all that stuff. It's a really... 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings are action books. They're if you know, like the movie 300 or Troy, it reads like that. It's basically these ancient battles that are going on, and the intrigue of the royal family, deception, lies, assassinations, killing, war. That's what 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings are all about. It's an interesting read. The problem that most people run into is the names. Like all these Hebrew names that sound weird. If you keep the names straight, it's a really exciting, fun, engaging read. And the thing that I've come up with is, as soon as I meet a character with a new name, I simplify it. I gave him a nickname. So Ishbosheth comes along, and I go, Ish. Okay. We're dealing with Ish here. And Ish is this guy, and he's kind of a wimp, and he gets appointed by Abner, I think, or Joab. And he's, like, trying to be king, but it doesn't work out, and David kills him. You simplify it that way, and it helps you read. And then you can get the story down. When you get the story down, you understand the flow of the narrative. You understand where we're headed with this whole thing. But anyway, that's a side point. Chapter 7 is the Davidic Covenant. The Davidic Covenant. So, how many covenants have we had so far? We had the Noahic Covenant, where God says, you know, I'm not going to flood the earth again. Here's the rainbow. That's going to mark that covenant. Abrahamic Covenant, we talked about that. Land, seed, and blessing. What's the mark of the Abrahamic Covenant?
Circumcision,
right. Mosaic Covenant, with all of the rules and the laws that Israel, the nation, needs to follow for blessings and curses. What's the mark of that covenant?
The sacrificial system.
Sacrificial system and the law and the temple. Good. So now we're into this next covenant, this promise between God and man, and it's between God and David, and he promises him something. So 2 Samuel chapter 7. So at this point, David has kind of established himself as king. He's having victories. He's brought the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem. He's trying to figure out what's going to be his legacy, basically. And he says, I want to build God a temple. You know, he's living in a tent right now. And I'm living in this house of cedars, this mansion kind of thing. And, you know, we gotta honor God, build him a temple. And so that's where the chapter starts, chapter 7. So, now, when the king lived in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from all his surrounding enemies, the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark dwells in a tent." And Nathan said to the king, "Go do all that's in your heart, for the Lord is with you." But that same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan. "Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, would you build me a house to dwell in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day. But I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges whom I command?" What is it?
It's a giant spider.
Huh?
Where's it at?
All right. Let's regroup.
Sorry, dude. I've
wanted to do it. It took us to do that.
I've been wanting to do it for a long time.
Can you just pop your legs up? I
leave the lid on. Because
yeah. All right. Regroup. Regroup.
Yeah.
All right. So what's going on? What happened so far?
There was a spider.
There was a spider.
What happened before that in the text?
We got to start over.
So David has this idea. What's David's idea?
Build a house for the Lord.
Build a temple.
Okay, so David wants to build a temple, right? What does Nathan tell him?
Do it.
Do it.
Go build it.
God,
okay.
Yeah.
What happened that night with Nathan?
Don't do it.
He's got a dream, and God says, "You shouldn't have told David that. That's not part of the plan."
Well, we haven't done that far.
Yeah.
In your reading.
Yeah, it's true. So we'll pick up in verse 6. That's pretty close to where. Chapter 7, 2 Samuel, verse 6. "I've not lived in a house since the day that I brought the people up out of Israel, out from Egypt to this day. But I've been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people of Israel, saying, 'Why have you not built for me a house of cedar?' Now therefore, you shall say to my servant David, 'Thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be a prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth.'" So what's he said so far to David?
"I've been with you.
I've been with you, and now I'm going to make you great." Verse 10. "And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you as that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." In accordance with all these words, in accordance with the vision Nathan spoke to David. So what did God promise David? Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever. I will establish your throne forever. And he also told him a little bit, "By the way, your son's going to be the one who builds me a temple, not you." That the Davidic covenant promised that his house and his throne shall endure forever is a huge thing when we get, spoiler alert, when we get further along in the story. The Messiah, the seed, he's going to have to fulfill this covenant too. He's layering all these covenants that he's going to come and take care of. And we could get really in-depth. We could talk for weeks just about the Davidic covenant. But
so is this where the point where the people start looking for a deliverer, for someone to protect them as far as other nations coming and attacking them?
No, I mean, they've been looking for that for a while. This is where they start looking to Son of David. This is where the idea of Messiah that we see fully formed in the first century in the Gospels starts building. and we're going to look at the other place where it builds a little bit more. But looking for David's offspring who's going to be the king who rules forever. That's kind of, this is where that starts. David, this is where we learn, okay, line of David, whoever is going to be the king who rules forever in Israel, he's got to come from David. And this is the promise that proves that. So that's why when you get to Matthew, when he starts out with that long genealogy, right? You guys have read Matthew 1? He starts out, he tells you where Jesus' ancestry came from, he traces him back to David. Because that's one of the priorities. We got to show how, if this is the Messiah, he's got to come from David. So show me how he's in his line.
Wasn't Mary actually, like, was Joseph also in the line of David, or was just Mary?
Lots of people say that. And the reason they get that is because you got two genealogies, right? Luke 3 and Matthew 1. So some people say Luke 3 traces Mary's ancestry, and Matthew 1 traces Joseph's ancestry. And I think there's good arguments for that. I don't hold to that position as, like, yes, that's got to be it. But,
well, but are they both in the line of David, I guess?
Unclear. For sure one of them is. For sure Joseph is, I should say that, because Matthew makes it clear that Joseph is.
Sure, if I was at the place of bed, it would be that Mary is the one that's in the line.
Yes.
Mary did not know Joseph biblically until after Jesus was born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I would think that God covers all of his bases.
Yeah.
Both of them come from David.
Yeah.
He's a successful leader from 2 Samuel 5 through 10. He does a lot of things that Saul couldn't do, finishes off a lot of the Philistine camps, defeats Ammon in Syria, really establishes the nation of Israel as we are the top dogs on the corner now. And then chapter 11 comes along. You guys know what 2 Samuel 11 is about? See, this is where if you have a paper Bible and you turn to 2 Samuel 11, it says like a heading that tells you exactly what it's about.
You have headings on the
Bathsheba. David commits adultery with Bathsheba. That's kind of where the story turns a little bit. And
but it's not adultery if you kill his husband.
Yeah. It's okay to commit adultery as long as you kill the woman's husband. That's the moral of the story.
Right?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, no.
You got that backwards, dude.
And you guys probably have heard that story somewhere along the way. David commits adultery with Bathsheba, has an illegitimate child, the child dies. And then Solomon is born. And the rest of 2 Samuel is about David's somewhat subpar fathering skills. And all the things that his children do, his last words, his mighty men, his census that the Lord says not to take, but he takes it anyway.
Joab told him not to.
Yeah.
Was it Joab that told him not to?
I don't remember.
It was either him or Nathan. Is that right?
Joab said to the king, "May the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many while their eyes are open." But why does my Lord King delight in this thing? Yeah. So yeah, Joab told him not to. First Kings then picks up the story. And it goes back a little bit. Or excuse me, it doesn't go back a little bit. It picks up the story with the kind of the end of David's reign and the beginning of Solomon's reign. So Solomon is David's son, and he reigns for 40 years. And he's the wise king. The wise king of Israel. Foolish lover.
That sounds like a song.
He liked the ladies. Solomon's famous for two things: being wise and having 1,000 wives.
They rhyme. Wise and wise.
Well, I think of his riches too, because you hear like Solomon's temple or Solomon's treasure.
That too. I'd agree.
Solomon's gold, Solomon's mines.
Yeah, he definitely increases the nation, and he does it through his wives. He marries a whole bunch of foreign ladies who have lots of money and power, and so he gets a little bit of money and power every time. He does build a temple just like 2 Samuel 7 said he would. So the first half of 1 Kings is really about designing and building the temple. And this is a big deal. Why is that a big deal, that a temple's being built?
Fulfilled promise.
Fulfilled promise by God? Good. Anything else?
There's an awesome prayer, just backing up a little bit, there's an awesome prayer that David does when they have all of the... David's the one that... Isn't he the one that puts together all the supplies?
Mm-hmm.
And there's an awesome prayer that he says before the... before they start building. But... that's pretty cool. It's my second favorite prayer.
So they had the tabernacle before?
There you go.
And now they'll have the temple?
They've had the tabernacle up until now, the tent. That's what David was talking about. God's been living in a tent all these years. And he says, I'm cool with the tent until Solomon comes along. Solomon builds the temple. Now we have this centralized
permanence.
Thank you. That's what I'm looking for. This permanent dwelling place of God on earth. This is where he lives. And everything revolves around the temple as far as Jewish customs and Jewish life from this point on. Sacrifice is going on continually. Burning of incense continually. They're going to be trying to follow the law on and off throughout the rest of Israel's history. And it's all because Solomon builds a temple. You guys know what this picture is of?
I'm trying to figure out what that little angel kid...
The baby cutting the baby in half.
Yeah,
it's the Solomon cutting the baby in half, right? You know that story? Yeah, so one woman comes along, or one woman comes along and her baby dies, and so she steals the other woman's baby. Or maybe I have it backwards. But anyway, she steals the live baby, and then the lady with the live baby comes along and says, excuse me, that's my kid. And they're like, Solomon, we both claim that this is our baby. What are you going to do about it? And Solomon says, well, let's cut the baby in half. Give half of them to her, half of them the other. And one of the women says, okay, let's do it. Give me my half. And the other one says, no, I'd rather see the other woman go than see the child die.
The other lady didn't really think that one through.
And Solomon says, okay, give it to the lady who didn't want the kid to die, because obviously she's the real mother. All
right, I would like half a baby.
And this sounds really weird to our 21st century ears, but in a world where... you're dealing with kids, people who sacrifice their kids to idols all the time, people who kill their kids for food all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
They eat their kids?
Yeah. It's weird. It wasn't as shocking back then that a woman would say, yeah, give me half the baby, because a kid is meat just as much as he is a kid. So the point is that the woman recognizes the purpose of life, the sanctity of life, and the need to preserve life.
I thought the only time that happened was when the
happens a couple times. Yeah, it didn't actually say that they're starving to the point of cannibalizing their kids at this point.
Uh-huh.
But neighboring countries are doing it.
Okay.
In famine, time of famine.
In the past, but I thought that was like extreme.
It is, yeah, and it is extreme.
That puts it into better perspective.
What are you talking about? I'm growing my own food.
Yeah.
I've always thought if somebody was going to steal a baby, they should at least try and play it off better than she did. Like, you know, whatever, I'll take half.
Yeah, I got the baby.
You just gave it away there. Like, showed your hand.
Yeah. Anyway, that's one of Solomon's... that's one of Solomon's moments of wisdom. He's the last ruler of the United Kingdom of Israel. So, after Solomon... So, who we had... Saul was the first king. Then Ishbosheth reigned for 2 years, but nobody really counts him in the lineage. He was kind of a fake king. David comes along. He reigns for 40 years, second king of Israel. And then Solomon comes along, David's son. He reigns for 40 years. How many years is that?
A lot.
40 times 3? 120? That's how long Israel was a united kingdom under a king. Because After that, we got Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So think back to, I have the map on the next one. So you remember when Joshua came and conquered all of Israel, and he divided up the land to all the different tribes? Remember the 12 tribes? Judah went to the south, and Benjamin went down with them. Levi spread throughout all of them. Manasseh was over here. Dan was up here. He divvied it up and gave all of the different tribes their land. Those tribes continued. Think of them kind of like states in the United States. They continued, and we get to the point where Solomon's dying off, and Rehoboam is not that great of a king. And Jeroboam is this guy up in Israel who says, why does Rehoboam get to be king? I want to be king. And so, civil war. Boom. Civil war. I can't say civil war nowadays without thinking of the meme. Civil war ensues. Jeroboam and Rehoboam split, and they say, Judah and Benjamin head off to the south. The other 10 tribes, they go up on the north, and they form Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Okay? So we got a divided kingdom. So now, all the rest of the history that we're dealing with is really dealing with kind of two nations that should be one, but aren't. Okay? And that's what 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles are all about, is the divided kingdom. You got Judah and Rehoboam in the south, Jeroboam and Israel in the north. And this chart, which is, some of you it's on the back side, some of you it's on the front of the last page. I stapled some of them backwards. Apologize. But this chart, this thing is so helpful when you understand it for understanding Kings and Chronicles. It tells you all the kings, their character, how long they reigned, when they reigned, and the prophets who were ministering to them.
I had something like this in my first Bible.
This is a wonderful chart.
Israel is bad.
So yeah, what do you notice? A few things. What did you just say?
All of Israel's kings are bad.
All of Israel's kings are bad. And you got 8 good kings in Judah. Really, it's 6 good kings and 2 kind of good kings. Joash and Amaziah are... they're good in their young years, and they get bad if they get older. And this is all straight from the text, too. If you go through and you read 2 Kings, and you go through and you read 2 Chronicles, it literally just walks through the history of all of these kings, and what they did in their nations, the battles that they won, the mistakes that they made, their character, what they did for the nation, and then it tells you either that they were good or they were bad. All of the kings in Israel, it says they followed in the sins of Jeroboam, their father. They basically, the number one sin in Israel and in Judah eventually, idol worship. For the whole history of Israel, from the judges all the way through the exile, idol worship is their problem. The very first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, is the one that they can't do. They constantly, constantly have other gods before Yahweh. And God gives them chance after chance, just like he does with us. During this time, so everybody understand the political dynamic, how Israel is functioning as a nation during this time? Yeah? You got Israel in the north, Judah in the south, a king is in charge. You've also got prophets. So this is where prophets become a big thing. Somebody tell me what a prophet is.
The mouthpiece of God.
Mouthpiece of God. Good. What does he do?
Prophesies.
Prophesies, which means?
He predicts the future.
Predicts the future. Good. What else does he do?
He's the mediator for the people to God,
too. Yeah. He'll talk to the people and to the kings, advise them. Tell them what God is thinking of their current actions. In Israel, prophets are constantly saying, look, you need to not be worshiping Baal and these golden calves that you're setting up as in place of God. You need to be worshiping Yahweh. Same thing in Judah, eventually. It goes on for many, many years. So you got your years there, right? Solomon, 790 to 930. look over at Israel first. All of them are bad. These are the prophets who ministered in Israel in the north. Okay? And what happens down here, 722?
Assyria comes in and takes them captive.
Yep. Assyria comes in and basically wipes them out. Northern kingdom is no more. So you could, looking at this map, Assyria comes in from the north. They attack and wipe out the northern kingdom. So Judah's soldiering on and oppression on every side. Kings of Judah, they last a little bit longer. They do some more good and bad kind of thing. They're following the line of David. They're trying to kind of keep in line with what God says. These are all the prophets who are ministering to Judah. And what happens in 586 BC?
Babylonian captivity.
Babylonian captivity. The exile. Babylonian exile. Notice how many years that is, okay? So you had 930 through 586. About how many years was that?
400.
My math people.
Yeah,
not quite 400 years. 350, somewhere in there. That's how long it took. You remember my little device for helping you think through history? How long has America existed? You think through all the history that's taken place in America, right? 240 years is how long America's existed. All the way from white powdered wigs, civil wars, French and Indian War, to iPhones. Think about all that history that's happened in America. That was 240 years. Okay, so from Rehoboam through Zedekiah is 350 years about.
340 years?
334. 334 years? 335 years? So more than America's existed, one and a half America's about. The reason I bring this up, the reason I hammer that home is to realize that this isn't like a, oh, one day everyone woke up and we just all decided to worship Baal. We said, yeah, who cares about God, Yahweh? We're all going to do our own thing. It didn't happen like that. It was a slow fade. It took a long time of constantly, slowly turning a little bit further away from the law and a little bit further away from God. It's a reminder to us, when we look at the nation of Israel and the history of Israel, and we're like, they just couldn't get it right. Come on. So many warnings, so many opportunities. All of these good kings come along and restore this good relationship. All throughout the period of the judges, 400 years of the judges, and they couldn't get it right. What's wrong with them? And when you add up the time, you add it up day by day by day, you realize that the nature of sin is such that men will not choose God. That's the point. When time shoots back out and you realize how much there was there, I get a little bit more understanding of Israel, because I know how hard it is for myself to follow after God. And I have the Holy Spirit's indwelling. And I have the grace of the Son. I have, the Messiah's already come. I know what he's done for me. They didn't have anywhere near as clear of knowledge of that. Their faith was harder than mine is. Anyway.
I have a question about the chart.
Yeah.
Okay, two questions actually. Why is there a gap between, on the Judah side, between Asa and Jehoshaphat, and then it doesn't look like it follows timeline-wise. Like, Hosea, or however you say that, is not in line at the same time as Josiah. Is that the case?
I'm lost as words.
Okay. So if you look at the last Israel, king of Israel, mm-hmm. number 19, if you go all the way across, it looks like it's at the same time as Josiah in Judah. But
gotcha.
Then it's not the same time according to the time. Like, 640 to 608 is Josiah, and Hoshea is 732 to 712.
Yeah.
So this, I'm just asking. I'm trying to get it.
I hear you. And I don't know, but
okay.
I'll look into it and see if I can find a reasonable answer.
Okay. And then there's the gap on
yeah.
Judah's side. Just curious.
That was a good question.
Asa was king during Baasha, Eli, Zimri, and Omri. They're looking at the chart, that gap right there.
It's more than.
Yeah, that makes sense in that part.
Right,
but down here, the years don't match up. So why wouldn't they continue?
They reign longer.
Why wouldn't they continue to put the gaps in to make the time match up? Is the question.
What's the Zimri guy?
Sorry?
Zimri for 7 days?
Yep.
Yeah, why is that?
Go read it.
Ooh, you know what? That would help too. You know what would help too? Is
yep.
if in here, what like the times that they reigned, if it would have the scripture
mm-hmm.
to refer back to.
And that's actually, I think this other one has that. Let me see. If you go and. Why not? If you go and Google Kings of Israel chart, plenty of things a lot like this one come up, which it'll give you different information. Some of them will give you the scripture references, what cover those kings. Some of them will give you a little bit of description of what the kings did. This is just the best one I found in terms of years, character, and prophets. I went along with all that. So, really good exercise that I'm planning on doing, that I haven't done yet, is making my own, where I have to just work through the biblical text, create my own chart. I would recommend doing that. The guys who've done it, they say, oh, it just clears up so many of those question mark errors.
So when did the two kingdoms get back together?
Good question. Anybody know? When do the two kingdoms get back together?
Oh, wait, they haven't yet,
they
right?
They get conquered.
They haven't yet.
Well, unless you consider the creation of Israel after World War II.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking,
yeah.
But
possibly what was that? 64, 68,
they were all.
Yeah. So the history wise, Israel, 10 tribes in the north, they get wiped out by Assyria. They're still lost. We don't know people who are descended from the tribe of Gad anymore.
Oh, really?
Unless
yeah.
you're Mormon.
Yeah, unless you're Mormon, in which case they have the secret knowledge of who's...
Which
yeah, we don't know where
wait,
there are probably... You might be descended from them.
Explain.
Descendants are from
the 10 tribes in the north, they're still lost. Only God knows who is descended from these tribes and who belongs to those tribes. And one day, Revelation says that he will mark them and that they will be regained. Yeah, we don't. So Assyria comes in, they annihilate, they kill a whole bunch of people, and they intermingle with them. So, you know the Samaritans in the New Testament? Okay, those are the half Israelite, half Assyrians who come in after the 77 destruction. That's why the Jews, short for Judah, right? That's why they hate the Samaritans so much, because they're the half-breeds. They're the ones who intermingled with the Assyrians and weren't following after the line of David. And they got destroyed. And they're still lost. The Jews that we think of today, those are just descendants of Judah and Levi and Benjamin. But Judah, they kind of subsumed.
Everyone that spelled it J-E-W.
Yeah, just phonetics. Because, yeah, Hebrew is a different language than English. Jew, yeah.
We don't have J-E-W.
Jew comes from Judah. And so if you're referring to Israel prior to the divided kingdom, you need to refer to them as Israelites. And if you're referring to the people who come back from exile, those are the Jews, right? Little pet peeve of mine. You guys know I have tons of pet peeves when people talk about the Jews prior to the exile.
I think doesn't understand.
Jews didn't exist prior to the exile, unless you're talking about the tribe of Judah. But so the prophets make up the largest portion of your text in terms of a chunk of genre. actually listen, I guess narrative. It's the largest. Yeah. Prophets make up a big, big portion of it. Anybody know all the prophets? Someone list them for me.
Okay. John the Baptist.
Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentation, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel.
Amos,
Obadiah,
Jonah,
Micah, Daniel, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Isaiah,
Matthew, Mark, John, Acts, Romans,
and the
Jesus.
Last is Malachi. Yep.
That's
the ABCD. Hebrews, James, for singing
the judgment. They ministered during the reigns of the kings, so we already talked about them a little bit. They predicted the future, they gave advice to kings, they told the people what their sins were and how they needed to repent. And if you read the prophets, which you should read the prophets, please read the prophets. It's the God perspective on what's going on in Second Kings. It's the all the kings are doing all of this terrible stuff, and here's what God thinks about it. That's what the prophets are. There's writing prophets versus non-writing prophets. So, writing prophets would be the prophets who wrote, and the non-writing prophets would be the prophets who didn't write. So, can you think of a prophet who wrote?
Isaiah.
Isaiah is a writing prophet. Think of a prophet who didn't write. We mentioned one earlier.
Elijah,
yeah.
Elisha.
Nathan.
Yeah, I didn't write.
You go look at this list, right? Any of those ones who don't have a book of the Bible named after them, they're non-writing prophets.
Shemaiah.
Yeah. I'm going to name my son Amos.
The prophets are some of the most life-giving literature in the Bible. The prophets are the ones who detail so many things that we know about the Messiah. Isaiah in particular, he just gives you so much information about who the seed, the one from 3:15, Genesis 3:15, the seed, the Messiah, the Savior, he tells you a whole lot of what he's going to be like. Common themes in the prophets, God's judgment, always a theme. There's always God telling Israel or Judah, look, you're not following me, and here's what's going to happen if you don't. Always, God's sovereignty is usually a strong theme. God's steadfast love for Israel in the midst of his judgment is always a strong theme. In almost all of the prophets, there'll be some pronouncement of judgment and some sort of pronouncement of, but I will preserve a remnant. I will remain faithful to my people, even when they're unfaithful. God's graceful restoration of Israel after judgment, another strong theme in all the prophets. You have two things on the back. One is a prophet's overview. So these are all of the writing prophets. These two little charts, I didn't make this one, but it's a good one. Tells you who the prophet is, what his name means, when he was ministering, and who he was talking to, and where he was from. Helpful little chart when you start studying the prophets. You realize that there's three sections of prophetic literature. So, let's back up. 586, what happened in there? Come back to where I can point it. Destruction of Jerusalem. That's a big date. If you remember, 586, destruction of the temple. Solomon's temple that he built in 1 Kings gets destroyed in 586 by Babylon. Okay. Come back to the map. So, 722, Assyria comes in, wipes out Israel in the north. 586, Babylon comes in, wipes out Judah. Okay, they take them off, cart them off to Babylon. 586, 722. Everybody say those dates.
586.
722. When Babylon comes in and destroys Judah, carts them off to Israel, life changes because they're in captivity now. They're off in Babylon, over here, off the map where you can't see. They're living in exile. So there's a couple books of the Bible that are written from exile. Anybody know? Name them. Daniel is written from exile.
Ezekiel,
he's an exilic prophet. Good.
That's all that's on your chart.
Jeremiah.
Parts of Jeremiah, yeah. Jeremiah actually is written about like the transition period before and after. And last one. Hint, it's a history. It tells a story about a lady.
Hosea.
No.
No.
Isis.
It's not a prophet.
Ruth. No. Ruth. No, 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 no.
Esther.
Esther.
Esther, there you go.
Ooh.
Esther is written from exile.
We'll get it in a minute.
These are the books written from exile while the nation of Israel is off in Babylon. Okay. Being punished for their disobedience to Yahweh. All that stuff that Deuteronomy 28 said would happen to them if they didn't obey, that God would bring in nations that would destroy them and crush them and kill them and take them off to land that they did not want to go. Yeah, all that happened when they went off to Babylon. And so from exile, there's a few people writing. Ezekiel and Daniel are the two big prophets who are writing from exile. Esther is written from exile. And then there's three prophets who wrote after they come back. So that's what we're going to talk about with Clint in 2 weeks, Ezra and Nehemiah, talking about what happens when they come back from exile. They spend 70 years off in this land that they don't want to be in, and then they get permission to come back, and what happens? This is a chart that I made up for you, kind of a purpose of each of the prophets. And each prophet is so rich when you read it. If you know the history, the reason you don't like reading the prophets is because you don't know the history. You don't know what's going on, what the nations are that he's talking about, the stuff that they're doing that God's mad at them for. It's like, why are you getting in such a big twist about this? Just, like, chill. But you read it with an understanding of the history, and you go, God's actually doing something. So feel free to read through this, refer back to it, store it in your files. We're going to dance through one of my favorite prophets right now, Habakkuk. So just to give you a taste of what the prophets are like, Habakkuk is one of my favorite prophets. Only 3 chapters long. Easy little read. Lots of the prophets are like that. And it just tells a story. It's Habakkuk reacting to God, crying out to God. So this is a basic outline. Cry for judgment on the wicked in Israel. And then God tells him, responds to that cry. Habakkuk kind of reacts to God's response. And then God responds to Habakkuk's reaction. And then Habakkuk figures out what to do about all this new information. So yeah, if you're in Habakkuk, it's after Nahum and before Zephaniah.
It's right there.
Page 1030 in my Bible. That,
I've never
heard that before,
Stephen. Habakkuk, chapter 1, verse 1. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, strife and contention arise, so the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. What's he crying out to God about?
These guys are bad.
People aren't doing what they should.
People aren't doing what they're doing. The law is paralyzed. Justice is not being done. The nation of Jerusalem is not following God's ways. Oh Lord, how long are you going to just let us go off on this road that leads to destruction? That's what he's saying. Yeah.
Nation of Jerusalem?
Yeah, nation of Judah, excuse me.
Okay.
City of Jerusalem. Thank you. He says, you know, I'm looking around and the law is paralyzed. When are you going to do something about all of this evil in Jerusalem? And God says, oh, I'm going to do something about it. Verse 5. Look among the nations and see and wonder and be astounded, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. Another word for Babylonians. I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. He marches through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not his own. He is dreaded and fearsome. His justice and dignity go forth from himself. His horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. He describes the leader of the nation of Chaldea, the Babylonians. He describes the fact that, yeah, he's going to do something about the wicked. He's going to kill them. And he's going to kill Habakkuk with them. He says, I'm going to raise up the nation of Chaldea. He's going to come in and destroy Jerusalem. There you go, Habakkuk. Answer to your question. And the end of chapter 1, verse 12 onward, is kind of like Habakkuk going, come again? Sorry. Think I misheard you. You said you're going to kill everybody? Verse 12, are you not from everlasting? O Lord my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for a proof. You who are of pure eyes and who see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish. Goes on, kind of, okay, but seriously, God, you know, the wicked. What are you going to do about the wicked? You're not going to kill everybody. And then verse 1 of chapter 2, I will stand at my watchpost, station myself on the tower, and look out and see what he will say to me, what he will answer concerning my complaint. And then God says, okay, no, I was serious. The Chaldeans are going to come and kill everyone. Write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so that he who runs may read it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Verse 4, behold, his soul is puffed up. Is he not upright within him? The righteous shall live by faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. And then he goes on describing through the rest of the chapter 2 how all the people who are going to be destroyed by the Chaldeans, wicked and righteous, Jews and Gentiles. Chapter 3 is after Habakkuk receives this final revelation, and it's basically him saying, okay, you're God and I'm not, so yeah, if you're going to kill everybody, I guess you're going to kill everybody. And the one promise of hope is verse 4 of chapter 2, the righteous shall live by faith. You will be resurrected. Kind of like God is saying, yeah, yeah, you're going to die, but I'm going to resurrect you. I'm going to resurrect the faithful. What's the rub? And the end of chapter 3, verse 17. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit beyond the vines, the produce of the olive fail, the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on high places. He says, in the end, I'm going to rejoice in the Lord, for he will save the righteous. They will live by faith. They will be resurrected. But he's going to kill us all in judgment of the wicked. So it's kind of this...
How did he die?
Don't know. Well, we assume that he dies from the Chaldeans, like chapter 2. Chapter 1 describes. But the message is God is sovereign and merciful, and the righteous, those who have faith, will be resurrected in the end. Yeah. God judges the wicked, and the righteous will live by faith. That's the point of the back. But, yeah, there's emotion, there's eschatology, things of the end, right? Resurrection, life, faith. It's all in the prophets. Anyway.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Whenever at the beginning when Habakkuk is complaining to God and he's complaining about the injustice that's going on, is he complaining, is it that Gentiles are being unjust to the Jews?
And there's two main views on that. I'll tell you both of them. The one that I take is that the righteous are the faithful Jews, and the unrighteous are the unfaithful Jews, the ones who are worshiping idols.
So it's Jew versus Jew, not necessarily Gentiles.
Other people would say that the unrighteous he's talking about is the Babylonians who are closing in.
Okay. And then a second question is talking about in chapter 1, starting in verse 12, whenever it says... you have appointed them to execute judgment. Who's them?
Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 12?
Yeah.
Them would be the Chaldeans.
Chaldeans, okay.
Yeah, the nation he was describing in verses 5 through 11.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Quick little review. So Here's the history we followed. Exodus. Try and have some kind of a picture in your mind with each of these terms, okay? Exodus, coming out of Egypt, parting the Red Sea, getting the law. Okay? 40 years of wandering. And then Joshua's conquest. Okay, coming in, taking the land, dividing it up among the 12 tribes. The judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. 340 years of that before God changes the status quo. Saul reigns for 40 years. David reigns for 40 years after him. Solomon reigns for 40 years after him. And then the divided kingdom. Israel in the north, Judah in the south. And then the period of the kings. So now, where we are in the story is northern tribes, Israel, is no more. They were destroyed by Assyria. And the people of Judah and Jerusalem, descendants from Judah, are often Babylonian exile, basically doing penance for all the time that they didn't follow God, didn't observe his laws. And that's where we'll pick up with Ezra and Nehemiah in 2 weeks.